You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered.
Listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community and supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Barbara Fuqua.
And I'm Scott Weddle. This is the Daily Local News for Wednesday, May 2nd, 2018. In today's feature report, we'll hear from Ayla Haas, a visiting assistant professor and Grand Challenge Fellow with the Robert H. McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis about some preliminary findings of the multi-million dollar initiative to study the opioid crisis in Indiana. That's coming up later in the program.
Also coming up in the next half hour, spies. What to watch out for and what you probably don't realize you're sharing. On a new edition of our Consumer Watchdog segment, Better Beware. But first, your daily headlines.
The Indiana Department of Transportation is warning Bloomington residents about increased traffic this week on Interstate 69. They say that's due to Indiana University's commencement ceremonies and the end of semester student travel. NDOT recommends avoiding Highway 37 as much as possible. Instead, residents are advised to use one of three alternative routes for commuting between Bloomington and Indianapolis. Now, according to NDOT, the most effective route is to take State Road 46 west to Spencer and then take State Road 67 north to Ameriplex Parkway just south of 465. Alternately, residents can take State Road 46 east to Nashville and then take 135 north to Indianapolis. The final option is to take State Road 46 east to Columbus and then I-65 north to Indianapolis. Residents should also be aware of closed entrances and exits onto 37. Pine Boulevard and Old State Road 37 access points are both closed to through traffic. Construction also continues on the 2nd and 3rd Street bridges, so crosstown traffic is also congested. NDOT suggests commuters use other east-west connections, such as Fullerton and Vernal Pike and State Road 46 if road congestion becomes too severe. It is not recommended that drivers who are unfamiliar with country roads attempt to utilize them to bypass traffic and construction, as GPS mapping software often does not work along certain stretches of the road. That's according to NDOT. NDOT also encourages motorists to reduce their speed, pay attention to their surroundings, and be patient during the inevitable traffic jams. Work on I-69 is currently full speed, according to NDOT. The department is hoping to complete Section 5 from Bloomington to Martinsville by its original August deadline. NDOT took over management of the project last summer after losing 2 years due to a failed public-private partnership.
Mike Chavez, supervisor of the Hoosier National Forest, reports funding for fighting wildfires is getting a boost. The $1.3 trillion omnibus spending bill Congress passed in March sets aside $20 billion over the next decade to support local firefighting efforts. Chavez reported on the impact of the allocation to county commissioners this morning. During the discussion, Commissioner Patrick Stofers asked Chavez to explain how western wildfires have a local impact.
So what a lot of people don't realize is we, in all years until 2020, we have to pay for the costs of wildfire suppression out of our regular appropriated budgets. And in more years than not, that amount does not cut it once we get to the end of fire season at the end of the summer. And we have to pull funds from recreation, from forest treatment, from lands, from everything else, in order to fight the rest of the season's wildfires that go on. And so we have to basically rob one program to keep feeding wildfire funding, and the cost has just gone up and up increasingly, where it now eats more than half of our budget on an annual basis. So Congress did something that's very helpful to us in getting that legislation passed, where now there's going to be a pot similar to FEMA, where there's a pot of money for the largest of the large, most expensive wildfires that happen, almost all of them out west. So we no longer have to steal from one pot to feed.
I was wanting to make sure I understood, so that when there's a wildfire out west, that impacts your budget locally.
It does, yeah, it does. They start when July, August rolls around, and if our wildfire suppression funds have been exhausted at that point, the national office starts looking for anything that's left on the table unspent. That's one piece, and also a lot of our employees locally are sent west to help fight those wildfires, so we lose capacity locally for a big chunk of the summer often.
Commissioner Julie Thomas and Chavez cautioned county residents to take care with outdoor burning.
It's important to keep an eye on the weather, because we had a weather statement yesterday about the winds and the low humidity,
yeah.
Right? I mean, and that impacts, that could potentially impact what we take pride in around here. So,
yes.
Be very careful, everyone, about burning outside and all of those things. Keep an eye on the weather.
Thank you. I appreciate that. We're in another day today of very high fire danger. Humidities are going to pick up a little bit today, which will help, and rain tomorrow, and then we should be much closer to full green up next week after the warm weather. But it has been a busy year so far with wildfires locally.
Chavez said the Hoosier National Forest is about 600 acres larger now than a year ago, thanks to federally funded land acquisitions. He said an ongoing partnership with the Sycamore Land Trust also contributes land. 145 acres of the Hoosier National Forest lies within Monroe County.
Last week, Monroe County Commissioners approved a $102,000 contract for body cameras worn by sheriff deputies and detectives. Sheriff's deputies have worn body cameras for some time, but the county is switching to its vendor to VView. Chief Technology Officer Eric Evans told commissioners one reason for the switch is to have a central access point for governmental departments.
As you know, with video evidence, a video clip at a fairly high resolution that would be used in court is a very large file. And what we were running into is that file that was being used as evidence would be copied and be sitting on our network in four or five different copies of the same thing, one for the public defender's office, one for the prosecutor's office, one for the sheriff's office. So by consolidating all that and storing it in the cloud, it's more scalable, it's more available to people, and it's a more efficient way of doing it.
Commissioners also approved an agreement with the City of Bloomington for a $70,000 incentive contract for CLR Incorporated. They are the contractor for the county's Country Club Drive Bridge project. Under the agreement, the county joins with the city and Bloomington Utilities Department to pay CLR to finish the project before the original July 26 completion date. County Attorney Dave Schilling explained.
And this agreement establishes a $2,000 per day incentive for each day before July 26th that the bridge is completed, with a cap of $70,000. And this agreement allocates the responsibility for that $70,000 as follows: $30,000 from the county, $30,000 from the Public Works Board, and $10,000 from the Utilities Service Board.
The Bloomington Utilities Service Board gave its approval for the incentive contract last night. City Attorney Chris Wheeler explained that under the agreement, the board's payment is the last to kick in.
CBU doesn't have to make any payment unless CLR Incorporated actually completes its work in excess of 30 days prior to the contract's original completion date. In that case, we would pay for 5 days' worth of additional early completion at $2,000 per day for a total of not to exceed $10,000.
Utilities Director Vic Kelson told the board the goal is to reduce overlap between the Country Club Drive project and a city utilities project at Grimes Lane, slated to begin in June.
The idea is that the city and the county are both committed to spending up to $30,000 a piece to save time. That would pay for the upcharge for finishing 30 days early. If they finish 30 days earlier, there would be about 2.5 or 3 weeks overlap with our project. But if they could go up to another week sooner, then we would pitch in for up to another week. So we might be able to get the overlap down to about, if everything went perfectly and we ended up paying the $10,000, the overlap would be about 2 weeks.
The Grimes Lane project is the last leg of the city's South Central Sewer Interceptor project. Board member Amanda Burnham asked Kelson whether expediting the project was realistic.
In terms of the contractors, do they think it's actually feasible to get it expedited?
I believe they will do everything they can to make the money. So they will do everything they can to get it done.
Later in the meeting, Kelson reported financial consultants have begun reviewing the city's sewer and storm water rates.
We will be doing a cost of service study for sewer, looking at a variety of factors in the billing rates as the board had suggested. So that process will be beginning in the next few weeks. They can reuse a lot of the information that we had from the 2016 rate case, which will streamline it and reduce the cost of proceeding with this. So we'll be looking at that and also looking at the stormwater rate with an eye towards the capital projects like completing the corrective action at the Jordan River culvert that we did repairs on under 3rd Street. We're going to be continuing with that through the year.
Kelson told the board he anticipates coming to them with a proposal for new sewer and stormwater rates in the fall.
The Monroe County Convention Center Advisory Commission is recommending splitting the Convention Center expansion into two separate projects. Commission Chair John Weichert brought the formal recommendation to the county commissioners in their work session last week. He began by recapping the original request for qualifications process.
As you recall, it's actually been a year now. April of 2017, an RFQ was put out for parties interested in one of several parts of a packet, if you will. So interested in building a hotel, interested in expanding the current convention center, or interest in both projects in combination. We had two respondents to that proposal within the timelines. The response was due. One of the respondents was a financial advisor who was offering financial services and consulting services. The other was Sun Development, who responded and said that they were interested in both the hotel development as well as the convention center expansion.
Sun Development has already provided conceptual designs for both an expanded center and a hotel project. But with the passage of a food and beverage tax, the commission thinks other parties might now be interested in handling the convention center expansion alone.
So in our meeting, we actually had a formal motion that we bring to you as a recommendation. And that is that, one, that the design and construction of the public civic convention center expansion be separated as a project from the private development of the Embassy Suites Hotel. And that, two, we reaffirm our support for our continued relationship with Sun Development to design and construct the Embassy Suites Hotel, and we continue our negotiations with them as we move that part of the project forward.
Weichert says Sun Development has indicated it would remain interested in the project should the commissioners open a new RFQ process. The recommendation Weichert presented comes with a suggestion to look for an architect with specific experience working within public-private partnerships. The commissioners took no formal action on the recommendation in their work session. If they accept the commission's recommendation, a new RFQ could go out as early as next month.
Support for WFHB comes from Cardinal Spirits Distillery, located on the B Line. Cardinal Spirits has opened a new kitchen featuring local seasonal food made from scratch to complement their craft cocktails. Dinner is available Tuesday through Saturday at Cardinal Spirits, 922 South Morton Street. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Barbara Fuqua.
And I'm Scott Weddle. Last fall, IU President Michael McRobbie announced the university will allocate $50 million into researching Indiana's opioid epidemic. The Grand Challenges Initiative launched 16 projects to study and analyze opioid addiction across the state. On Thursday, IU released some preliminary recommendations based on the law and public policy approach to tackling the state's opioid epidemic. Ayla Haas is visiting assistant professor and Grand Challenge Fellow with the Robert H. McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis. In this interview with WFHB News Director Wes Martin, Professor Haas discusses some of the law and policy barriers, preliminary findings of the Grand Challenges Project.
So our project is a result of funding that we received from the university's Grand Challenge. This one is about responding to the addictions crisis. So it's a university-wide initiative to advance research and interventions in response to the substance use crisis that's affecting Indiana and, frankly, the whole country. The goals of the Grand Challenge are threefold. One, to reduce the incidence of substance use disorder. Second, to decrease opioid-related deaths. And finally, to decrease the number of babies born with neonatal abstinence syndrome. And these kinds of projects that are funded during this stage, there's 16 of them, and they cross a variety of domains related to data sciences, education and training, translational research, and community and workforce development. And then finally, the project that I've been involved in is related to law and policy analysis.
So what is the time frame for the Grand Challenges initiatives?
It's a multi-year long process that includes this phase one funding that was released and, you know, now the whole initiative was announced in the fall. Funding was released in January. And our project goes through the summer. And then they recently announced phase two funding opportunities. So folks have been applying for grants to continue on research in this vein. So I don't have the specific details in terms of how long the funding is going to be going on, but the research activity is certainly over the course of several years.
Just recently, the Grand Challenges, or IU, announced the first set of, preliminary recommendations when combating the opioid crisis in Indiana. Can you talk a little bit more about what those recommendations are, what they represent?
Sure thing. So just for clarification, the report that came out is a project, one of 16 projects that were funded by Grand Challenge. So I wouldn't say that it was the recommendations of the Grand Challenge in general, but just from the research team that was focusing on law and policy barriers. So this report was conducted in a team of three faculty members across both the law school and the Fairbanks School of Public Health in Indianapolis, along with a few other research assistants that from both the law school and the public health school. And our report was focusing on legal and policy practices in response to the substance abuse crisis. So the report outlines our preliminary findings related to law and policy interventions that can be used to respond to the crisis here in Indiana, but again, also could be applicable nationally. And our findings were based on two buckets of research. The first one was a qualitative study where we interviewed 20 individuals with expertise in responding to the opioid crisis. And they included folks from a variety of fields, including public health and law enforcement and healthcare, among others. And we supplemented the information from our interview with original research, and with the goal of actually identifying some of the legal barriers to an effective response, as well as what opportunities that might be there. And in general, we found from across our conversations and from our research that there were a few very consistent messages that we took away. Number one is that we cannot arrest our way out of this crisis. This is a public health problem. It's not a criminal law problem. And we have to treat substance use disorder as a disease, not a crime. Second, no one has to die from this addiction. We have the tools necessary to prevent opioid overdose deaths, and what we need are resources and law and policy underpinnings to ensure that we have access to these resources. And finally, that the crisis is no longer a prescription opioid crisis. That's something that's come across our desk and from our conversations over and over again. This is a broader addiction crisis, and we're seeing not only high rates of prescription opioid use, but also synthetic and illicit opioid use. And frankly, we're also seeing increasing rates of meth and cocaine use. And so whatever law and policy initiatives and interventions are being undertaken, they can't ignore this fact and focus just on the prescription opioid issue. So just to give one example, one of our categories of our recommendations was related to harm reduction. And so what harm reduction is interventions that are trying to minimize the illness and injury associated with drug use and not necessarily trying to reduce the actual incidence or rates of drug use. And so some of those examples might be increasing naloxone, which is an overdose intervention drug, increasing access to naloxone. It could also include syringe exchange programs. It could include safe injection sites. And so what we found is that we've seen a lot of progress here in Indiana in terms of in trying to improve harm reduction strategies via law and policy mechanisms. For example, we've seen a variety of changes in Indiana's law related to increasing opioid access. Now we've got laws on the books that allow for syringe exchange programs. But what we've also seen is that there are some barriers related to the effective implementation of these harm reduction strategies. So, for example, Indiana law now authorizes local governments to implement syringe exchange programs. Yet we also have criminal laws on the books under Indiana code that make possession of a syringe, so even one that was obtained from a lawfully operated syringe exchange program, as a violation of Indiana's drug paraphernalia law. And in fact, when you actually possess a syringe for drug use, that's been escalated not just to from a misdemeanor to actual felony. So in that way, we are creating these programs which we know are effective in terms of reducing substance use. We know they're effective in terms of increasing the likelihood of folks with opioid use disorder from seek treatment. We know they decrease rates of overdose and diseases like hep C and HIV, yet having a syringe from one of these programs is a violation of Indiana law. Another example is Indiana's overdose immunity law. It is unique in that it links overdose immunity, so let's say bystander immunity for someone who's a family member or friend with someone experiencing an overdose. If they pick up the phone and want to call emergency services, then they might be able to get criminal immunity for, let's say, drug possession or drug use. And so the whole point of the law is to increase the incidence of reaching out to emergency services. However, the law only applies to the bystander, so that family member or friend, and doesn't actually apply to the person experiencing the overdose. And so we know from a variety of studies that sometimes folks don't want to contact emergency services because they're not only worried about their own personal criminal liability, but that of their loved one. Indiana's law is also unique in that it only applies if the bystander actually administers naloxone. So if you don't happen to just have naloxone on you during this situation, then you wouldn't necessarily be getting the protections from the law.
Professor Haas, I'm wondering if you can tell me, a lot of these are things that community partners have been saying, that we can't arrest our way out of this public health crisis and to treat it like a public health crisis, and that we need bystander immunity laws. And I just wanted to check in, has there been any feedback or has there been any communication or collaboration with community service providers when it comes to looking at some of the policy recommendations to take away from this law and policy barriers study?
Absolutely. So as I had mentioned, we structured the study as not just our own research, but actually doing interviews with 20 individuals that work on the ground, either here in Indiana or nationally, on a variety of the topic areas that we highlighted in our report. So we absolutely connected with folks that are public health practitioners, that supported community organizations and agencies, that worked in law enforcement or in other aspects of the criminal justice system. And while we don't actually disclose the individuals that we communicated with in their report, just so that they were able to speak to us freely, that was absolutely something that we wanted to ensure that we do, that we weren't just reading about the issue, but actually talking about folks that have experience in the field. And I think
that was Ayla Haas, visiting assistant professor and Grand Challenge Fellow with the Robert H. McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis. More information on Grand Challenges findings is available online at grandchallenges.iu.edu.
The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
Up next, our weekly consumer watchdog segment, Better Beware.
Welcome to Better Beware. Here's your consumer watchdog from WFHB Community Radio with the latest information and helpful hints designed to keep your head out of the clouds, your feet on the ground, and your money in your pocket.
Spy. And he's totally cool, you know that, always using his super tech gadgets to foil the bad guys. Well, James Bond is fiction, but spies are real. And today there are thousands of them who are trying to spy on you, and you're helping them do it. Today, spies don't have to sneak up on you or plant a bug in your house. It's already there, and all they have to do is turn it on. We are surrounded by microphones now, everywhere we go, even in your bedroom while you're sleeping. They're in your smartphone, they're in your smart TV, they're in your children's toys, and especially, they're in that digital assistant thing you've got. A digital assistant is listening to you all the time. It's supposed to listen for its name. Siri, if you've got an iPhone, Cortana on Windows phones, Google Now, Vocool, Evie, Genie, Sarah, and Alexa, the lady in a box who comes with Amazon's Echo. Oh, digital assistants can do a lot of things now that we've finally reached the age of voice-programmed computers, as predicted way back in 1970 by the Firesign Theater.
This is Worker speaking. Hello.
Hello. How are you? State maintenance question.
But this convenience comes with a huge cost. Just this past week, security firm Checkmarks announced they had found a way to make Alexa record everything she hears and then transcribe all the spoken words into a searchable document and send it to the bad guys. Amazon says they've patched this hole in their security, but there's no guarantee somebody won't hack around their patch or find a whole new way to turn on Alexa's microphone and hear everything you say. The National Security Agency can turn your smartphone on and listen in if they want to. We've known that for a while. They're supposed to have a court order, but they can do it anyway, anytime. Not long ago, VTech, a maker of smart children's toys, was slapped with a $650,000 fine because their toys collected info on kids and their parents, and their database got hacked, exposing millions of families on the dark web. You can do some things to protect what's left of your privacy, like reading the terms and conditions on every device or app you get, which is connected to the Internet, and protecting each one with a separate, long, strong password. That's a lot of trouble, but you really need to do it. And beware of free apps and programs which are completely unregulated because they were made in God knows where-istan. About the only simple defense you've got is twofold. One, be aware that you're being overheard. And two, when you aren't actually using a gadget with a microphone, turn it off. The name's Fish, Richard Fish, for WFHB News and Public Affairs.
Better Beware comes to you from WFHB Bloomington, Indiana. Find all our episodes at WFHB.org. If you can help put the kibosh on a con, email beware@WFHB.org. Remember, swindlers never give a sucker an even break.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Jonah Chester along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week in partnership with Community Access Television Services. Better Beware was produced by Richard Fish. Our feature was produced by Wes Martin. And I'm Barbara Fuqua.
Engineer today, Jenna Jankowski. Theme music provided by Ben Lumsdaine, Danny Graff, and Scott Schmadeke. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, this is Scott Weddle.